though it is significant that the 18th ruling steward of Gondor was named Egalmoth, as the 17th and 25th were named Ecthelion, the Lord of the Rings, Appendix A, 1, 2. Footnote. In a very late note written on one of the texts that constitute Chapter 16 of the Silmarillion, of Maeglin, my father was thinking of making the three lords of his household, whom Turgon appointed to ride with Orethel from Gondolin, page 131, Lorfindel, Ecthelion, and Egalmoth. He notes that Ecthelion and Egalmoth are derived from the primitive fall of Gondolin, but that they are well-sounding and have been in print, with reference to the names of the stewards of Gondor. Subsequently, he decided against naming Orethel's escort. End of footnote. Glorfindel of the Golden Hair, page 192, remains yellow-haired Glorfindel in the Silmarillion, and this was from the beginning the meaning of his name. 6. The Battle of Gondolin, pages 174-88. Virtually the entire history of the fighting in Gondolin is unique in the tale of the fall of Gondolin. The whole story is summarized in The Silmarillion, page 242, in a few lines. Of the deeds of desperate valor they are done by the chieftains of the noble houses and their warriors, and not least by Tuor, much is told in the fall of Gondolin. Of the battle of Ecthelion of the Fountain with Gothmog, lord of Balrogs, in the very square of the king, where each slew the other. And of the defense of the tower of Turgon by the people of his household, until the tower was overthrown. And mighty was its fall, and the fall of Turgon in its ruin. Tuor sought to rescue Edoril from the sack of the city, but Maeglin had laid hands on her, and on Eorendil. And Tuor fought with Maeglin on the walls, and cast him far out, and his body as it fell smote the rocky slopes of Amon Gwareth thrice, ere it pitched into the flames below. Then Tuor and Edoril led such remnants of the people of Gondolin as they could gather in the confusion of the burning, down the secret way which Edoril had prepared. In this highly compressed account, the detail that Maeglin's body struck the slopes of Amon Gwareth three times before it pitched into the flames was retained. It would seem from the Silmarillion account that Maeglin's attempt on Edoril and Eorendil took place much later in the fighting, and indeed shortly before the escape of the fugitives down the tunnel. But I think that this is far more likely to be the result of compression than of a change in the narrative of the battle. In the tale, Gondolin is very clearly visualized as a city, with its markets and its great squares, of which there are only vestiges in later writing, see above page 207, and there is nothing vague in the description of the fighting. The early conception of the Balrogs makes them less terrible, and certainly more destructible, than they afterwards became. They existed in hundreds, page 170, and were slain by Tuor and the Gondothlim in large numbers. Thus five fell before Tuor's great axe, Drumboleg, three before Ecthelion's sword, and 20 were slain by the warriors of the king's house. Footnote. They existed in hundreds. The idea that Morgoth disposed of a host of Balrogs endured long, but in a late note my father said that only very few ever existed, at most 7. End of footnote. The Balrogs are demons of power, page 181. They are capable of pain and fear, page 194. They are attired in iron armor, pages 181-194, and they have whips of flame, a character they never lost, and claws of steel, pages 169-179. In the Silmarillion, the dragons that came against Gondolin were of the brood of Glaurung, which were become now many and terrible. But as in the tale, the language employed, page 170, suggests that some at least of the monsters were inanimate devices, the construction of smiths in the forges of Angband. But even the things of iron that opened about their middles to disgorge bands of orcs are called ruthless beasts, and Gothmog bade them pile themselves, page 176. Those made of bronze or copper were given hearts and spirits of blazing fire, while the fire drake that Tuor hewed screamed and lashed with its tail, page 181. A small detail of the narrative is curious. What messengers did Maeglin send to Melkor to warn him to guard the outer entrance of the Way of Escape, where he guessed that the secret tunnel must lead in the end? Whom could Meglin trust sufficiently, and who would dare to go? 7. The Escape of the Fugitives and the Battle in Kristhorn, pages 188 to 95. The story as told in the Silmarillion, page 243, is somewhat fuller in its account of the escape of the fugitives from the city and the ambush in the Eagle's Cleft, there called Kirith Thoronoth, than in that of the assault and sack itself. But only in one point are the two narratives actually at variance. As already noticed, the Eagle's Cleft was afterwards moved from the southern parts of the encircling mountains to the northern, and Idril's tunnel led north from the city. The comment is made that it was not thought that any fugitives would take a path towards the north and the highest parts of the mountains and the nighest to Angband. The tale provides a richness of detail and an immediacy that is lacking in the short version, where such things as the tripping over dead bodies in the hot and reeking underground passage have disappeared. And there is no mention of the Gondothlim who, against the Council of Idril and Tuor, went to the Way of Escape and were there destroyed by the dragon lying in wait, or of the fight to rescue Eärendil. Footnote: the dragon lying in wait. This element in the story was in fact still present in the 1930 Silmarillion, see footnote on page 208. But I excluded it from the published work on account of evidence in a much later text that the old entrance to Gondolin had by this time been blocked up, a fact which was then written into the text in chapter 23 of the Silmarillion. End of footnote. In the tale appears the keen-sighted elf Legolas Greenleaf, first of the names of the Fellowship of the Ring to appear in my father's writings. See page 217 on this earlier Legolas. Followed by Gimli, an elf, in the tale of Tenuvil. In one point, the story of the ambush in Kristhorn seems difficult to follow. This is the statement on page 193 that the moon lit not the path for the height of the walls. The fugitives were moving southwards through the encircling mountains, and the sheer rock wall above the path in the Eagle's Cleft was of the right or westerly hand, while on the left there was a fall dreadly steep. Surely then the moon rising in the east would illuminate the path. The name Kristhorn appears in my father's drawing of Gondolin and the Vale of Tumladen from Kristhorn, September 1928. Pictures by J.R.R. Tolkien, 1979, number 35. 8. The Wanderings of the Exiles of Gondolin, pages 195-7. In the Silmarillion, page 243, it is said that, led by Tuor, son of Huor, the remnant of Gondolin passed over the mountains and came down into the Vale of Sirion. One would suppose that they came down into Dimbar, and so, fleeing southward by weary and dangerous marches, they came at length to Nontotheren, the land of willows. It seems strange in the tale that the exiles were wandering in the wilderness for more than a year, and yet achieved only to the outer entrance of the Way of Escape. But the geography of this region may have been vaguer when The Fall of Gondolin was written. In the Silmarillion, when Tuor and Idril went down from Nontotheren to the mouths of Sirion, they joined their people to the company of Elwing, Dior's daughter, that had fled thither but a little while before. Of this there is no mention here, but I postpone consideration of this part of the narrative. Section 2. Entries in the name list to the Fall of Gondolin. On this list, see page 148, where the headnote to it is given. Specifically, linguistic information from the list, including meanings, is incorporated in the appendix on names, but I collect here some statements of other kind, arranged in alphabetical order, that are contained in it. Bablon was a city of men, and more rightly, Babylon, but such is the gnome's name as they now shape it, and they got it from men aforetime. Bonsil. Now this name had the Gondothlim for that tree before their king's door, which bore silver blossom and faded not, and its name had Elfriniel from his father Voronwe, and it meaneth fair gleam. Now that tree, of which it was a shoot, brought in the deep ages out of Valinor by the Noldali, had like properties, but greater, seeing that for half the 24 hours it lit all Valinor with silver light. This the Eldar still tell of as Silphion, or Cherry Moon, for its blossom was like that of a cherry in spring. But of that tree in Gondolin they know no name, and the Nordali tell of it alone. Dor Lomind, or the Land of Shadows, was that region named of the Eldar Hisalome, and this means shadowy twilights, where Melkor shut men. And it is so called by reason of the scanty sun which peeps little over the iron mountains to the east and south of it. There dwell now the Shadow Folk, thence came Tuor to Gondolin. Eärendil was the son of Tuor and Idril, and is said the only being that is half of the kindred of the Eldalie and half of men. He was the greatest and first of all mariners among men, and saw regions that men have not yet found nor gazed upon for all the multitude of their boats. He rideth now with Voronwë upon the winds of the firmament, nor comes ever further back than Kor, else would he die like other men, so much of the mortal is in him. For these last statements about Eärendil, see pages 264-5. The statement that Eärendil was the only being that is half of the kindred of the Eldalie and half of men is very notable. Presumably this was written when Beren was an elf, not a man, see page 139. Dior, son of Beren and Tinuviel, appears in The Tale of the Nauglofring, but there Beren is an elf, and Dior is not half elven. In The Tale of the Fall of Gondolin itself, it is said, but in a later replacement passage, page 164 and note 22, that Tuor was the first but not the last to wed a daughter of Elfenesse. On the extraordinary statement in The Tale of Turambar that Tamar Lamefoot was half elven, see page 130. Ecthelion was that lord of the House of the Fountain who had the fairest voice and was most skilled in musics of all the Gondolin. He won renown forever by his slaying of Gothmog, son of Melko, whereby Tuor was saved from death, but Ecthelion was drowned with his foe in the King's Fountain. Egolmoth was lord of the House of the Heavenly Arch, and got even out of the burning of Gondolin, and dwelt after at the mouth of Sirion, but was slain in a dire battle there when Melko seized Elwing. See page 258. Galdor was that valiant gnome who led the men of the tree in many a charge, and yet won out of Gondolin and even the onslaught of Melko upon the dwellers at Sirion's mouth, and went back to the ruins with Eärendil. He dwelleth yet in Tol Eressëa, said Elfrinil, and still do some of his folk name themselves Nos Goldon, for Goldon is a tree, and thereto Galdor's name akin. The last phrase was amended to read, Nos non Olwen, for Olwen is a tree. For Galdor's return to the ruins of Gondolin with Eärendil, see page 258. Glingol meaneth singing gold, 'tis said, and this name was that which the Gondothlim had for that other of the two unfading trees in the king's square which bore golden bloom. It also was a shoot from the trees of Valinor, see rather where Elfrith has spoken of Vansil. But of Linda Lochte, which is singing cluster, or Laurelin, emended from Linda Laure, which is singing gold, which lit all Valinor with golden light for half the 24 hours. For the name Linda Lochte, see 1:22-258, entry Lindalos. Glorfindel led the golden flower and was the best beloved of the Gondothlim, save it be Ecthelion, but who shall choose? Yet he was hapless and fell slaying a Balrog in the great fight in Christhorn. His name meaneth Goldtress, for his hair was golden, and the name of his house in Noldorissa, Los Loriol, emended from Lost Gloriol. Gondolin meaneth stone of song, whereby figuratively the gnomes meant stone that was carven and wrought to great beauty. And this was the name most usual of the seven names they gave to their city of secret refuge from Melko in those days before the release. Gothmog was a son of Melko and the ogress Fluithuin, and his name is Strife and Hatred. And he was captain of the Balrogs and lord of Melko's hosts ere fair Ecthelion slew him at the taking of Gondolin. The Eldar named him Kosmoko, or Kosomok, Kosomoko. But 'tis a name that fitteth their tongue no way, and has an ill sound even in our own rougher speech, said Elfrith, emended from Elfriniel. In a list of names of the Valar associated with the tale of the coming of the Valar, 193, it is said that Melko had a son by Ulbandi called Kosomot. The early Kenya dictionary gives Kosomoko equals gnomish Gothmog, 1:258. In the tale, Gothmog is called the Marshal of the Hosts of Melko, page 184. In the later development of the legends, Gothmog was the slayer of Feanor, and in the Battle of Unnumbered Tears, it was he who slew Fingon and captured Húrin, the Silmarillion, pages 107, 193, 195. He is not, of course, called later Son of Melkor. The Children of the Valar was a feature of the earlier mythology that my father discarded. In the Third Age, Gothmog was the name of the lieutenant of Minas Morgul, the Return of the King, 5-6. Hendor was a house carl of Idril's and was aged, but bore Earendel down the secret passage. Idril was that most fair daughter of the King of Gondolin, whom Tuor loved when she was but a little maid, and who bare him Earendel. Her the elves name Irilde, and we speak of as Idril Tal Celeb, or Idril of the Silver Feet, but they Irilde Taltalepta. See the appendix on names, entry Idril. Indor was the name of the father of Tuor's father, wherefore did the gnomes name Earendel Gon Indor, and the elves Indorildo, or Indorion. Legolas, or Green Leaf, was a man of the tree who led the exiles over Tumladen in the dark, being night-sighted. And he liveth still in Tol Eressëa, named by the Eldar there, Lycalasse. But the Book of Rúmnil saith further hereon, see 1:267, entry Thari Lysi. Section 3, Miscellaneous Matters. 1. The Geography of the Fall of Gondolin. I have noticed above, page 205, that in Tuor's journey all along the coast of what was afterwards Beleriand to the mouths of Sirion, there is an unquestionable resemblance to the later map, in the trend of the coast from north-south to east-west. It is also said that after he left Falasquil, the distant hills marched ever nearer to the margin of the sea, and that the spurs of the Iron Mountains run even to the sea, pages 152-3. These statements can likewise be readily enough related to the map, where the long western extension of the Mountains of Shadow, Erid Wethrin, forming the southern border of Nevrast, reached the sea at Vinyamar. For the equation of the Mountains of Iron and the Mountains of Shadow, see 1:111-12. Arliskion, the place of reeds, page 153, above the mouths of Sirion, survived in Lisgarth, the land of reeds at the mouths of Sirion, in the later Tuor, page 34. And the feature that the great river passed underground for a part of its course goes back to the earliest period, as does that of the Mirrors of Twilight, Eilin Uial, the Pools of Twilight, page 195. There is here, however, a substantial difference in the tale from the Silmarillion, page 122, where Eilin Uial was the region of great pools and marshes where the flood of Sirion was stayed. South of the Mirrors, the river fell from the north in a mighty fall, and then he plunged suddenly underground into great tunnels that the weight of his falling waters delved. Here, on the other hand, the pools of twilight are clearly below the cavern of the tumultuous winds, never mentioned later, where Sirion dives underground. But the land of willows, below the region of Sirion's underground passage, is placed as it was to remain. Thus the view I expressed, page 141, of the geographical indications in the tale of Turambar can be asserted also of those of the fall of Gondolin. 2. Ulmo and the other Valar and the fall of Gondolin. In the speech of Tuor, inspired by Ulmo, that he uttered at his first meeting with Turgon, page 161, he said, "The hearts of the Valar are angered, seeing the sorrow of the thraldom of the Noldali and the wanderings of men." This is greatly at variance with what is told in The Hiding of Valinor, especially the following, 1:208-9. Footnote. It also seems to be at variance with the story that all men were shot in Hithlum by Melko's decree after the Battle of Unnumbered Tears. But wanderings is a strange word in the context, since the next words are, "For Melko ringeth them in the land of shadows." End of footnote. The most of the Valar, moreover, were fain of their ancient ease and desired only peace, wishing neither rumour of Melko and his violence nor murmur of the restless gnomes to come ever again among them to disturb their happiness. and for such reasons they also clamored for the concealment of the land. Not the least among these were Varna and Nessa, albeit most even of the great gods were of one mind. In vain did Ulmo of his foreknowing plead before them for pity and pardon on the Noldali. Subsequently, Tuor said, page 161, the gods sit in Valinor, though their mirth is minished for sorrow and fear of Melko, and they hide their land and weave about it inaccessible magic that no evil come to its shores. Tuagon, in his reply, ironically echoed and altered the words, they that sit within, that is, in Valinor, reck little of the dread of Melko or the sorrow of the world, but hide their land and weave about it inaccessible magic, that no tidings of evil come ever to their ears. How is this to be understood? Was this Ulmo's diplomacy? Certainly Turgon's understanding of the motives of the Valar chimes better with what is said of them in The Hiding of Valinor. But the gnomes of Gondolin reverenced the Valar. There were pomps of the Ainur, page 165. A great square of the city and its highest point was Gar Ainion, the place of the gods, where weddings were celebrated, pages 164, 186. And the people of the Hammer of Wrath reverenced Aule the Smith more than all other Ainur, page 174. Of particular interest is the passage, page 165, in which a reason is given for Ulmo's choice of a man as the agent of his designs. Now Melko was not much afraid of the race of men in those days of his great power, and for this reason did Ulmo work through one of this kindred for the better deceiving of Melko, seeing that no Valar and scarce any of the Eldar or Noldali might stir unmarked of his vigilance. This is the only place where a reason is expressly offered, save for an isolated early note where two reasons are given. One, the wrath of the gods, that is, against the gnomes. Two, Melko did not fear men. Had he thought that any messengers were getting to Valinor, he would have redoubled his vigilance and evil and hidden the gnomes away utterly. But this is too oblique to be helpful. The conception of the luck of the gods occurs again in this tale, pages 188, 200, note 32, as it does in the tale of Turambar, see page 141. The Ainur put it into Tuor's heart to climb the cliff out of the ravine of Golden Cleft for the saving of his life, page 151. Very strange is the passage concerning the birth of Earendel, page 165. In these days came to pass the fulfillment of the time of the desire of the Valar and the hope of the Eldalie. For in great love Idril bore to Tuor a son, and he was called Earendel. Is it to be understood that the union of elf and mortal man and the birth of their offspring was the desire of the Valar, that the Valar foresaw it, or hoped for it, as the fulfillment of a design of Ilúvatar, from which great good should come? There is no hint or suggestion of such an idea elsewhere. 3. Orcs. There is a noteworthy remark in the tale, page 159, concerning the origin of the orcs, or orqui, as they were called in Tuor A and in Tuor B as first written. All that race were bred of the subterranean heats and slime. There is no trace yet of the later view that naught that had life of its own, nor the semblance of life, could ever Melkor make since his rebellion in the Ainulindale before the beginning, or that the orcs were derived from enslaved Quendi after the awakening, the Silmarillion, page 50. Conceivably, there is a first hint of this idea of their origin in the words of the tale in the same passage, unless it be that certain of the Noldali were twisted to the evil of Melko and mingled among these orcs, although, of course, this is, as it stands, quite distinct from the idea that the orcs were actually bred from elves. Here also occurs the name Glomhoth of the orcs, a name that reappears in the later Tuor, pages 39 and 54, note 18. On Balrogs and Dragons in the Fall of Gondolin, see pages 212 to 13. 4. Noldorin in the Land of Willows. Did not even after the days of Tuor, Noldorin and his Eldar come there seeking for Dor Lomin and the hidden river and the caverns of the gnomes' imprisonment? Yet thus nigh to their quest's end were like to abandon it. indeed sleeping and dancing here, they were whelmed by the goblins sped by Melko from the hills of iron, and Noldoran made their escape thence. Page 154. This was the battle of Tassarinon, mentioned in the tale of Turambar, pages 70-140, at the time of the great expedition of the elves from Kor. Compare Lindo's remark in The Cottage of Lost Play, 1.16, that his father, Valwë, went with Noldoran to find the gnomes. Noldoran, Salmar, companion of Ulmo, is also said in the tale to have fought beside Tulkas at the Pools of Twilight against Melko himself, though his name was struck out, page 195 and note 38. This was after the Battle of Tassarinon. On these battles, see pages 278 and following. 5. The Stature of Elves and Men. The passage concerning Tuor's stature on page 159, before it was rewritten, see note 18, can only mean that while Tuor was not himself unusually tall for a man, he was nonetheless taller than the elves of Gondolin, and thus agrees with statements made in the tale of Turambar, see page 142. As he mended, however, the meaning is rather that men and elves were not greatly distinct in stature. 6. Isfin and Eol. The earliest version of this tale is found in the little Lost Tales notebook, C. 1171, as follows. Isfin and Eol. Isfin, daughter of Fingolma, loved from afar from Eol, Arval, of the mole kin of the gnomes. He is strong and in favor with Fingolma and with the sons of Feanor, to whom he is a kin, because he is a leader of the miners and searchers after hidden jewels, but he is ill-favored and Isfin loathes him. Fingolma, as a name for Finwë Norlëmë, appears in outlines for Gilfanon's tale, 1.238-9. We have here an ill-favored miner named Eol, of the Mole, who loves Isfin, but is rejected by her with loathing. And this is obviously closely parallel to the ill-favored miner Meglin with the sign of the sable mole seeking the hand of Idril, who rejects him in the fall of Gondolin. It is difficult to know how to interpret this. The simplest explanation is that the story adumbrated in the little notebook is actually earlier than that in the fall of Gondolin, that Meglin did not yet exist, and that subsequently the image of the ugly miner, unsuccessful suitor, became that of the sun, the object of desire, becoming Idril, niece of Isfin. While a new story was developed for the father, Eol, the dark elf of the forest, who ensnared Isfin. But it is by no means clear where Eol the miner was when he loved from afar Isfin, daughter of Fingolma. There seems to be no reason to think that he was associated with Gondolin. More probably, the idea of the miner bearing the sign of the mole entered Gondolin with Meglin. 4. The Nauglofring. We come now to the last of the original lost tales to be given consecutive narrative form. This is contained in a separate notebook, and it bears the title The Nauglofring, The Necklace of the Dwarves. The beginning of this tale is somewhat puzzling. Before the telling of the fall of Gondolin, Lindo told Littleheart that it is the desire of all that you tell us the tales of Tuor and of Eärendil as soon as may be. Page 144. And Littleheart replied, It is a mighty tale, and 7 times shall folk fare to the tale-fire ere it be rightly told. And so twined is it with those stories of the Nauglofring and of the Elf-march, that I would fain have aid in that telling of Ailios here. Thus Littleheart's surrender of the chair of the tale-teller to Ailios at the beginning of the present text, so that Ailios should tell of the Nauglofring, fits the general context well. But we should not expect the new tale to be introduced with the words, But after a while silence fell, since the fall of Gondolin ends, and no one in all the room of logs spake or moved for a great while. In any case, after the very long fall of Gondolin, the next tale would surely have waited to the following evening. This tale is once again a manuscript in ink over a wholly erased original in pencil, but only so far as the words, Sate his greed, on page 230. From this point to the end, there is only a primary manuscript in pencil in the first stage of composition, written in haste, in places hurled onto the page with a good many words not certainly decipherable. And a part of this was extensively rewritten while the tale was still in progress, see note 13. but now Glofring, the necklace of the dwarves. But after a while silence fell, and folk murmured Eorendil, but others said, Nay, what of the now Glofring, the necklace of the dwarves? Therefore said Ilfiniol, leaving the chair of the tale-teller, Yea, better would the tale be told if Ilios would relate the matters concerning that necklace. And Ilios, being nowise unwilling, thus began, looking upon the company. Remember ye all how Urin the Steadfast cast the gold of Glorund before the feet of Tinwelland, and after would not touch it again, but went in sorrow back to Hisalome, and there died. And all said that that tale was still fresh in their hearts. Behold then, said Ilios, in great grief gazed the king upon Urin as he left the hall, and he was weary for the evil of Melko that thus deceived all hearts. Yet tells the tale that so potent were the spells that Mim the Fatherless had woven about that hoard, that even as it lay upon the floor of the king's halls, shining strangely in the light of the torches that burnt there, already were all who looked upon it touched by its subtle evil. Now therefore did those of Urin's band murmur, and one said to the king, Lo, Lord, our captain Urin, an old man and mad, has departed, but we have no mind to forego our gain. Then said Tinwelland, for neither was he untouched by the golden spell, Nay, then, know ye not that this gold belongs to the kindred of the elves in common? For the Rodothlim, who won it from the earth long time ago, are no more, and no one has a special claim to so much as a handful, save only Urin, by reason of his son Turin, who slew the worm, the robber of the elves. Yet Turin is dead, and Urin will have none of it, and Turin was my man. Note 1. From Nay Then to Has a Special Claim. This sentence is a rewriting of the text, which had originally, Nay then, know ye not that this gold belongs to the kindred of the elves, who won it from the earth long time ago, and no one among men has claim. The remainder of this scene, ending with the slaughter of Urin's band, was rewritten at many points, with the same object as in the passage just cited, to convert Urin's band from men to elves, as was done also at the end of Eltos' tale, see page 118, note 33. Thus original elves was changed to elves of the wood, woodland elves, and original men to folk, outlaws, and see notes 2, 3, 5. End of note. At those words the outlaws fell into great wrath, until the king said, Get ye now gone, and seek not, O foolish ones, to quarrel with the elves of the forest, lest death or the dread enchantments of Valinor find you in the woods. Neither revile ye the name of Tinwelland, their king, for I will reward you richly enough for your travail and the bringing of the gold. Let each one now approach and take what he may grasp with either hand, and then depart in peace. Now were the elves of the wood in turn displeased, who long had stood nigh gazing on the gold. But the wild folk did as they were bid, and yet more, for some went into the hoard twice and thrice, and angry cries were raised in that hall. Then would the woodland elves hinder them of their thieving, and a great dissension arose, so that though the king would stay them, none heeded him. Then did those outlaws, being fierce and fearless folk, draw swords and deal blows about them, so that soon there was a great fight, even upon the steps of the high seat of the king. Doughty were those outlaws, and great wielders of sword and axe from their warfare with orcs. Note 2, the original sentence here was, Doughty were those men and great wielders of sword and axe, and still in those unfaded days might mortal weapons wound the bodies of the elfin folk. See Note 1. End of note. So that many were slain ere the king, seeing that peace and pardon might no longer be, summoned a host of his warriors, and those outlaws, being wildered with the stronger magics of the king, and confused in the dark ways of the halls of Tinwelland, were all slain, fighting bitterly. Note 3. The original sentence here was, And those men being wildered with magics. See Note 1. End of note. But the king's hall ran with gore, and the gold that lay before his throne, scattered and spurned by trampling feet, was drenched with blood. Thus did the curse of Mim the dwarf begin its course. And yet another sorrow sown by the Norderly of old in Valinor was come to fruit. Note 4. This sentence from And Yet Another Sorrow was added to the text later. End of note. Then were the bodies of the outlaws cast forth, but the woodland elves that were slain Tinwellant leapt very nigh to the knoll of Tinuriel. And 'tis said that the great mound stands there still in Artenor, and for long the fairies called it Cum an Idrisaith, the mound of Avarice. Now came Gweniel to Tinwellant and said, Touch not this gold, for my heart tells me it is trebly cursed, cursed indeed by the dragon's breath, and cursed by thy liege's blood that moistens it, and the death of those they slew. Note 5. Those, the text has the men, obviously left unchanged through oversight. See note 1. End of note. But some more bitter and more binding ill, methinks, hangs over it that I may not see. Then remembering the wisdom of Gweniel his wife, the king was minded to hearken to her, and he bade gather it up and cast it into the stream before the gates. Yet even so he might not shake off its spell, and he said to himself, First will I gaze my last upon its loveliness ere I fling it from me forever. Therefore he let wash it clean of its stains of blood in clear waters, and display it before him. Now such mighty heaps of gold have never since been gathered in one place, and some thereof was wrought to cups, to basins, and to dishes, and hilts there were for swords, and scabbards, and sheaths for daggers, but the most part was of red gold unwrought, lying in masses and in bars. The value of that hoard no man could count, for amid the gold lay many gems, and these were very beautiful to look upon, for the fathers of the Rodothlim had brought them out of Valinor, a portion of that boundless treasury the Nordali had there possessed. Now as he gazed, Tinwellant said, How glorious is this treasure! And I have not a tithe thereof, and of the gems of Valinor none, save that Silmaril, that baron, won from Angamondi. But Gweniel, who stood by, said, And that were worth all that here lies, were it thrice as great. Then arose one from among the company, and that was Ufferin, a gnome. But more had he wandered about the world than any of the king's folk. And long had he dwelt with the Naugloth and the Indrafongs, their kin. The Naugloth are a strange race, and none know surely whence they be. And they serve not Melko nor Munwe, and reck not for elf or man. And some say that they have not heard of Ilúvatar, or hearing disbelieve. Howbeit in crafts and sciences, and in the knowledge of the virtues of all things that are in the earth or under the water, none excel them. Note 6. In the earth is an emendation of the original reading, on the earth. End of note. Yet they dwell beneath the ground in caves and tunneled towns. And aforetime Nogrod was the mightiest of these. Old are they, and never comes a child among them, nor do they laugh. They are squat in stature, and yet are strong, and their beards reach even to their toes. But the beards of the Indrafongs are the longest of all, and are forked, and they bind them about their middles when they walk abroad. All these creatures have men called dwarves, and say that their crafts and cunning surpass that of the gnomes in marvelous contrivance. But of a truth, there is little beauty in their works of themselves, for in those things of loveliness that they have wrought in ages past, such renegade gnomes as was Ufferin have ever had a hand. Now long had that gnome forsaken his folk, becoming leagued with the dwarves of Nogrod, and was at that time come to the realms of Tinwellant with certain other Nordali of like mind, bearing swords and coats of mail, and other smithyings of exquisite skill, in which the Naugloth in those days did great traffic with the free Nordali, and 'tis said with the orcs and soldiers of Melko also. As he stood in that place, the spell of the gold had pierced the heart of Ufferin more deeply than the heart of any there, and he could not endure that it should all be cast away. And these were his words, An evil deed is this that Tinwellant the king intends, or who hereafter shall say that the kindreds of the Eldalie love things of beauty, if a king of the Eldar casts so great a store of loveliness into the dark woodland waters where none but the fishes may after behold it? Rather than this should be, I beg of thee, O king, to suffer the craftsmen of the dwarves to try their skill upon this unwrought gold, that the name of the golden treasury of Tinwellant become heard in all lands and places. This will they do, I promise thee, for small guerdon, might they but save the hoard from ruin. Then looked the king upon the gold, and he looked upon Ufedin, and that gnome was clad very richly, having a tunic of golden web and a belt of gold set with tiny gems. And his sword was damasked in strange wise, but a collar of gold and silver interlaced most intricate was round his neck. And Tinwellant's raiment could in no wise compare with that of the wayfarer in his halls. Note 7. Damasked in strange wise, that is, damascene, ornamentally inlaid with designs in gold and silver. The word damascene is used of the sword of Tinwellant made by the dwarves, on which were seen images of the wolf hunt, page 227, and of Glorfindel's arms, page 173. End of note. Again looked Tinwellant upon the gold, and it shone yet more alluring fair. Nor ever had the sparkle of the gems seemed so brilliant. And Ufedin said again, "Or in what manner, O king, dost thou guard that Silmaril of which all the world hath heard?" Now Gweniel warded it in a casket of wood bound with iron. And Ufedin said it was shame so to set a jewel that should not touch aught less worthy than the purest gold. Then was Tinwellant abashed, and yielded. And this was the agreement that he made with Ufedin. Half the gold should the king measure and give to the hands of Ufedin and his company, and they should bear it away to Nogrod and the dwellings of the dwarves. Now those were a very long journey southward beyond the wide forest on the borders of those great heaths nigh Umboth Muilin, the pools of twilight, on the marches of Tassadanab. Yet after but 7 full moons back, with the Naugloth fair bearing the king's loan all wrought to works of greatest cunning, yet in no wise would the weight and purity of the gold be minished. Then would they speak to Tinwellant, and an he liked not the handiwork, then would they return and say no more. Yet if it seemed good to him, then of that which remained would they fashion such marvellous things for his adornment and for Gweniel the queen as never had gnome or dwarf made yet. "For," said Ufedin, "the cunning of the Naugloth have I learnt, and the beauty of design that only can the Nordally compass do I know. Yet shall the wages of our labour be small indeed, and we will name it before thee when all is done." Then by reason of the glamour of the gold, the king repented his agreement with Ufedin, and he liked not altogether his words. And he would not suffer so great a store of gold to be borne without surety out of his sight for 7 moons to the distant dwellings of the dwarves. Yet was he minded nonetheless to profit by their skill. Therefore suddenly he let seize Ufedin and his folk, and he said unto them, "Here shall ye remain as hostages in my halls until I see again my treasury." Now Tinwellant thought in his heart that Ufedin and his gnomes were of the utmost service to the dwarves, and no covetous would be strong enough to bring them to forsake him. But that gnome was very wroth, saying, "The Naugloth are no thieves, O king, nor yet their friends." But Tinwellant said, "Yet the light of overmuch gold has made many thieves who were not so before." And Ufedin perforce consented, yet he forgave not Tinwellant in his heart. Therefore was the gold now borne to Nogrod by folk of the king, guided by one only of Ufedin's companions. And the agreement of Ufedin and Tinwellant spoken to Naugladur, the king of those places. Now, during the time of waiting, Ufedin was kindly entreated in the courts of Tinwellant, yet was he idle perforce, and he fretted inwardly. In his leisure he pondered ever what manner of lovely thing of gold and jewels he would after fashion for Tinwellant. But this was only for the greater ensnaring of the king, for already he began to weave dark plots, most deep of avarice and revenge. On the very day of the fullness of the 7th moon thereafter, the watchers on the king's bridge cried, "Lo, there comes a great company through the wood, and all, it seems, are aged men, and they bear very heavy burdens on their backs." But the king, hearing, said, "It is the Naugloth who keep their tryst. Now mayst thou go free, Ufedin, and take my greeting to them, and lead them straightway to my hall." And Ufedin sallied forth gladly, but his heart forgot not its resentment. Therefore, having speech privily with the Naugloth, he prevailed upon them to demand at the end a very great reward, and one thereto that the king might not grant unhumbled. And more of his designs also did he unfold, whereby that gold might fare in the end to Nogrod forever. Now come the dwarves nonetheless over the bridge and before the chair of Tinwelland, and behold the things of their workmanship they had conveyed thither in silken cloths, and boxes of rare woods carven cunningly. In otherwise had Urin haled the treasure thither, and half thereof lay yet in his rude sacks and clumsy chests. Yet when the gold was once more revealed, then did a cry of wonder arise, for the things the Naugloth had made were more wondrous far than the scanty vessels and the ornaments that the Rodothlim wrought of old. Cups and goblets did the king behold, and some had double bowls or curious handles interlaced, and horns there were of strange shape, dishes and trenchers, flagons and ewers, and all appurtenances of a kingly feast. Candlesticks there were, and sconces for the torches, and none might count the rings and armlets, the bracelets and collars, and the coronets of gold. And all these were so subtly made, and so cunningly adorned, that Tinwelland was glad beyond the hope of Wulfthedon. But as yet the designs of Wulfthedon came to naught, for in no wise would Tinwelland suffer, or him, or those of the Naugloth, to depart to Nogrod, with or without that portion of the unwrought gold that yet remained. And he said, "How shall it be thought that after the weariness of your burdened journeys hither I should let you so soon be gone, to noise the lack of courtesy of Tinwelland abroad in Nogrod? Stay now a while and rest and feast, and afterward shall ye have the gold that remains to work your pleasure of, or shall aught of help that I or my folk may afford be wanting in your labor, and a reward rich and more than just awaits you at the end." But they knew nonetheless that they were prisoners, and trying the exits privily found them strongly warded. Being therefore without counsel, they bowed before the king, and the faces of the dwarf folk show seldom what they think. Now after a time of rest was that last smithying begun in a deep place of Tinwelland's abode, which he caused to be set apart for their uses, and what their hearts lacked therein fear supplied. And in all that work Wulfthedon had a mighty part. A golden crown they made for Tinwelland, who yet had worn naught but a wreath of scarlet leaves, and a helm too most glorious they fashioned. And a sword of dwarven steel brought from afar was hilted with bright gold, and damascened in gold and silver, with strange figurings wherein was pictured clear the wolf-hunt of Carcharus Knife-Fang, father of wolves. That was a more wonderful sword than any Tinwelland had seen before, and outshone the sword in Wulfthedon's belt the king had coveted. These things were of Wulfthedon's cunning, but the dwarves made a coat of linked mail of steel and gold for Tinwelland, and a belt of gold. Then was the king's heart gladdened, but they said, "All is not finished," and Wulfthedon made a silver crown for Gwenyl, and aided by the dwarves contrived slippers of silver crusted with diamonds, and the silver thereof was fashioned in delicate scales, so that it yielded as soft leather to the foot. And a girdle he made, too, of silver blended with pale gold. Yet were those things but a tithe of their works, and no tale tells a full count of them. Now when all was done, and their smithcraft given to the king, then said Wulfthedon, "O Tinwelland, riches of kings, dost thou think these things fair?" And he said, "Yea." But Wulfthedon said, "Know then that great store of thy best and purest gold remaineth still, for we have husbanded it, having a boon to ask of thee, and it is this: we would make thee a carcanet, and to its making lay all the skill and cunning that we have, and we desire that this should be the most marvellous ornament that the earth has seen, and the greatest of the works of elves and dwarves. Therefore we beg of thee to let us have that Silmaril that thou treasurest, that it may shine wondrously amid the Naugloffring, the necklace of the dwarves." Then again did Tinwelland doubt Wulfthedon's purpose. Yet did he yield the boon, and they would suffer him to be present at that smithying. "None are that yet live," quoth Ilios, "who have seen that most glorious thing, save only Little Heart, son of Bronwyg, yet are many things told thereof." Note 8. Ilios, the text has Eltos, but with Ilios written above in pencil. Since Ilios appears as the teller at the beginning of the tale and not as the result of emendation, Eltos here was probably no more than a slip. End of note. Note 9, save only, is a later emendation of the original not even. See page 256. End of note. Not only was it wrought with the greatest skill and subtlety in the world, but it had a magic power. And there was no throat so great or so slender whereon it sat not with grace and loveliness. Albeit a weight beyond belief of gold was used in the making, lightly it hung upon its wearer as a strand of flax. And all such as clasped it about their necks seemed, as it hung upon their breasts, to be of goodly countenance, and women seemed most fair. Gems uncounted were there in that carcanet of gold, yet only as a setting that did prepare for its great central glory and led the eye thereto, for amidmost hung like a little lamp of limpid fire, the Silmaril of Feanor, jewel of the gods. Yet, alas, even had that gold of the Rhodothlim held no evil spell, still had that carcanet been a thing of little luck. For the dwarves were full of bitterness, and all its links were twined with baleful thoughts. Now, however, did they bear it before the king in its new gleaming splendor. And then was the joy of Tinwellant, king of the woodland elves, come to its crowning, and he cast the Nauglofring about his throat, and straightway the curse of Mim fell upon him. Then said Ufethin, Now, O Lord, that thou art pleased beyond thy hope, perchance thou wilt grant the craftsmen thy kingly reward, and suffer them to depart also in joy to their own lands. But Tinwellant, bewildered by the golden spell and the curse of Mim, liked not the memory of his tryst. Yet dissembling, he bid the craftsmen come before him. And he praised their handiwork with royal words. At length, said he, 'Twas said to me by one Ufethin that at the end such reward as ye wished ye would name before me, yet would it be small enough, seeing that the labor was of love and of Ufethin's desire that the golden hoard be not cast away and lost. What then do ye wish that I may grant?' Then said Ufethin scornfully, 'For myself nothing, O Lord. Indeed, the guest kindliness of thy halls for 7 moons and 3 is more than I desire.' But the dwarves said, 'This do we ask. For our labors during 7 moons, each 7 jewels of Valinor, and 7 robes of magic that only Gwendolyn can weave, and each a sack of gold. But for our great labor during 3 moons in thy halls unwilling, we ask each 3 sacks of silver, and each a cup of gold wherein to pledge thy health, O King, and each a fair maiden of the woodland elves to fare away with us to our homes.'" Note 10. It is odd that Gwendolyn appears here, not Gweniel, as hitherto in this tale. Since the first part of the tale is in ink over an erased pencil text, the obvious explanation is that the erased text had Gwendolyn, and that my father changed this to Gweniel as he went along, overlooking it in this one instance. But the matter is probably more complex. One of those small puzzles with which the texts of the Lost Tales abound. For after the manuscript in ink ceases, the form Gweniel occurs, though once only, and Gwendolyn is then used for all the rest of the tale. See Changes Made to Names, page 244. End of note. Then was King Tinwellant wroth indeed. For what the dwarves had asked was of itself a goodly treasury, seeing that their company was very great. And he had no mind thus to devour the dragon's hoard, but never could he deliver maidens of the elves unto ill-shapen dwarves without undying shame. Now that demand they had made only by the design of Ufethin, yet seeing the anger of the king's face, they said, "Nay, but this is not all, for in payment of Ufethin's captivity for 7 moons, 7 stout elves must come with us and abide 7 times 7 years among us as bondsmen and menials in our labor." Thereat arose Tinwellant from his seat, and calling summoned his weapon, thanes, and warriors, that these surrounded the Naugloth and those gnomes. Then said he, "For your insolence, each 3 stripes with stinging withes shall ye receive, and Ufethin 7, and afterwards will we speak of recompense." When this was done, and a flame of bitter vengeance lit in those deep hearts, he said, "Lo, for your labor of 7 months, 6 pieces of gold and 1 of silver each shall have. and for your labors in my halls, each 3 pieces of gold and some small gem that I can spare. For your journey hither a great feast shall ye eat, and depart with good store against your return. And ere ye go, ye shall drink to Tenwellent in elfin wine. Yet mark ye, for the sustenance of Ufethan, 7 idle months about my hall shall ye each pay a piece of gold and of silver too. For he has not aught himself, and shall not receive since he desires it not. Yet methinks he is at the bottom of your arrogance. Then were the dwarves paid their reward like common smiths of bronze and iron, and constrained to yield once more therefrom payment for Ufethan. Else, said the king, never shall ye get him hence. Then sat they to a great feast, and dissembled their mood. Yet at the end the time of their going came, and they drank to Tinwellant in elfin wine, but they cursed him in their beards. And Ufethan swallowed not, and spat the wine from his mouth upon the threshold. Now tells the tale that the Naugloth fared home again, and if their greed had been kindled when first the gold was brought to Nogrod, now was it a fierce flame of desire. And moreover they burnt under the insults of the king. Indeed all that folk love gold and silver more dearly than aught else on earth. For that treasury was haunted by a spell, and by no means were they armed against it. Now one there had been, Fangluin the aged, who had counselled them from the first never to return the king's loan. For said he, Ufethan we may later seek by guile to release, if it seem good. But at that time this seemed not policy to Naugladur their lord, who desired not warfare with the elves. Footnote. Fangluin, in the margin of the manuscript is written, Fangluin Bluebeard. End of footnote. Yet now did Fangluin jeer at them mightily on their return, saying they had flung away their labor for a botcher's wage, and a draught of wine, and gotten dishonor thereto. But he played upon their lust, and Ufethan joined his bitter words thereto. Therefore did Naugladur hold a secret council of the dwarves of Nogrod, and sought how we might both be avenged upon Tinwellant and sate his greed. Note 11. Here the manuscript in ink ends. See page 221. End of note. Yet after long pondering, he saw not how he might achieve his purpose, save by force. And there was little hope therein, both by reason of the great strength of numbers of the elves of Artanor in those days, and of the woven magic of Gweniel that guarded all those regions. So the men of hostile heart were lost, and came not to those woods. Nor indeed could any such come thither unaided by treachery from within. Now even as those aged ones sat in their dark halls and gnawed their beards, behold a sound of horns, and messengers were come from Bodruith of the Indrafangs, a kindred of the dwarves that dwelt in other realms. Now these brought tidings of the death of Mim the Fatherless at the hand of Urin and the rape of Glorin's gold, which tale had but new come to Bodruith's ears. Now hitherto the dwarves knew not the full tale concerning that hoard, nor more than Ufethan might tell, hearing the speech in Tinwellant's halls, and Urin had not spoken the full count thereof ere he departed. Hearing therefore these tidings, new wrath was added to their lust, and a clamour arose among them, and now Glaudur vowed to rest not ere Mim was thrice avenged. And more, said he, meseems the gold belongs of right to the people of the dwarves. This then was the design, and by his deeds have the dwarves been severed in feud for ever since those days with the elves, and drawn more nigh in friendship to the kin of Melko. Secretly he let send the Indrafangs that they prepare their host against a day that he would name, when so the time should be ripe. And a hidden forging of bitter steel then was in Belagost, the dwelling of the Indrafangs. Moreover, he gathered about him a great host of the orcs and wandering goblins, promising them a good wage, and the pleasure of their master, moreover, and a rich booty at the end. And all these he armed with his own weapons. Now came unto Naugladur an elf, and he was one of Tinwellant's folk, and he offered to lead that host through the magics of Gwendolyn, for he was bitten by the gold lust of Glorin's hoard, and so did the curse of Mim come upon Tynwellynt, and treachery first arose among the elves of Artenor. Then did Nauglodur, smile, in brackets, bitterly, for he knew that the time was ripe, and Tynwellynt delivered to him. Now each year about the time of the great wolf hunt of Beren Tynwellynt was wont to keep the memory of that day by a hunt in the woods. And it was a very mighty chase, and thronged with very many folk, and knights of merriment and feasting were there in the forest. Now Glaudur learnt of that elf Narthsake, whose name is bitter to the Eldar yet, that the king would fare a-hunting at the next high moon but one, and straightway he sent the trysted sign, a blood-stained knife, to Modruith at Belagost. Now all that host assembled on the confines of the woods, and no word came yet unto the king. Now tells the tale that one came unto Tynwellynt, and Tynwellynt knew him not for the wild growth of his hair. And lo, it was Moblung, and he said, "Lo, even in the depths of the forest have we heard that this year you will celebrate the death of Carcharus, with a high tide greater than even before, O king, and behold, I have returned to bear you company." And the king was full of mirth, and fain to greet Moblung the brave. And at the words of Moblung that Hwan, captain of dogs, was come also into Artenor, was he glad indeed. Behold now Tynwellynt the king rode forth a-hunting, and more glorious was his array than ever aforetime. And the helm of gold was above his flowing locks, and with gold were the trappings of his steed adorned. And the sunlight amid the trees fell upon his face, and it seemed to those that beheld it like to the glorious face of the sun at morning. For about his throat was clasped the Nauglofring, the necklace of the dwarves. Beside him rode Moblung, the heavy hand, in the place of honor, by reason of his deeds of that great hunt aforetime. But Hwan of the dogs was ahead of the hunters, and men thought that great dog bore him strangely. But mayhap there was something in the wind that day he liked not. Now was the king far in the woods with all his company, and the horns grow faint in the deep forest. But Gwendolen sits in her bower, and foreboding is in her heart and eyes. Then said an elf-maid, Nielfi, "Wherefore, O lady, art thou sorrowful at the high tide of the king?" And Gwendolen said, "Evil seeks our land, and my heart misgives me that my days in Artenor are speeding to their end. Yet if I should lose Tynwellynt, then would I wish never to have wandered forth from Valinor." But Nielfi said, "Nay, O Lady Gwendolen, hast thou not woven great magic all about us, so that we fear not?" But the queen made answer, "Yet meseems there is a rat that gnaws the threads, and all the web has come unwoven." Even at that word, there was a cry about the doors, and suddenly it grew to a fierce noise by the clash of steel. Then went Gwendolen unafraid forth from her bower, and behold, a sudden multitude of orcs and Indrafangs held the bridge, and there was war within the cavernous gates. But that place ran with blood, and a great heap of slain lay there, for the onset had been secret and all unknown. Then did Gwendolen know well that her foreboding was true, and that treachery had found her realm at last. Yet did she hearten those few guards that remained to her, and had fared not to the hunt, and valiantly they warded the palace of the king until the tide of numbers bore them back, and, in brackets, fire and blood found all the halls and deep ways of that great fortress of the elves. Then did those orcs and dwarves ransack all the chambers seeking for treasure, and lo, one came and sate him in the high seat of the king, laughing loud. And Gwendolen saw that it was Ufethin, and mocking he bid her be seated in her ancient seat beside the king's. Then Gwendolen gazed upon him so that his glance fell, and she said, "Wherefore, O renegade, dost thou defile my lord's seat? Little had I thought to see any of the elves sit there, a robber stained with murder, a league fellow of the truceless enemies of his kin. Or thinkest thou it is a glorious deed to assail an ill-armed house what time its lord is far away?" But Ufethin said naught, shunning the bright eyes of Gwendolen, wherefore said she anew, "Get thee now gone with thy foul orcs, lest Tynwellynt coming repay thee bitterly." Then at last did Ufethin answer, and he laughed, but ill at ease, and he looked not at the queen. But he said, listening to a sound without, Nay, but already is he come. And behold, now Glaudur entered now, and a host of the dwarves were about him. But he bore the head of Tinwellant, crowned and helmed in gold. But the necklace of all wonder was clasped about the throat of now Glaudur. Then did Gwendolen see in her heart all that had befallen. And now the curse of the gold had fallen on the realm of Artenor, and never has she danced or sung since that dark hour. But now Glaudur bid gather all things of gold or silver or of precious stones and bear them to Nogrod. And whatso remains of goods or folk may the orcs keep or slay as they desire. Yet the Lady Gwendolen, Queen of Artenor, shall fare with me. Then said Gwendolen, Thief and murderer, child of Melko, yet art thou a fool, for thou canst not see what hangs over thine own head. By reason of the anguish of her heart was her sight grown very clear, and she read by her fey wisdom the curse of Mim and much of what would yet betide. Then did now Glaudur in his triumph laugh till his beard shook, and bid seize her, but none might do so. For as they came towards her, they groped as if in sudden dark, or stumbled and fell tripping each the other. And Gwendolen went forth from the places of her abode, and her bitter weeping filled the forest. Now did a great darkness fall upon her mind, and her counsel and law forsook her, that she wandered she knew not whither for a great while. And this was by reason of her love for Tinwellant the king, for whom she had chosen never to fare back to Valinor and the beauty of the gods, dwelling always in the wild forests of the north. And now did there seem to her neither beauty nor joy, be it in Valinor or in the lands without. Many of the scattered elves in her wayward journeyings she met, and they took pity on her, but she heeded them not. Tales had they told her, but she hearkened not overmuch since Tinwellant was dead. Nonetheless must ye know how, even in the hour that Ufevan's host brake the palace and despoiled it, and other companies as great and as terrible of the orcs and Indrafangs fell with death and fire upon all the realm of Tinwellant. Behold, the brave hunt of the king were resting amid mirth and laughter, but Huon stalked apart. Then suddenly were the woods filled with noise, and Huon bayed aloud. But the king and his company were all encircled with armed foes. Long they fought bitterly there among the trees, and the Naugloth, for such were their foes, had great scathe of them, or ever they were slain. Yet in the end were they all foredone, and Mablung and the king fell side by side. But now Glaudur it was who swept off the head of Tinwellant after he was dead. For living he dared not so near to his bright sword or the axe of Mablung. Note 12. Against this sentence my father wrote a direction that the story was to be that the Naugloffring caught in the bushes and held the king. End of note. Now doth the tale know no more to tell of Huon, save that even while the sword still sang, that great dog was speeding through the land, and his way led him, as the ? Wind in brackets, to the land of Iguilwortham, the living dead, where reigned Beren and Tinuviel, the daughter of Tinwellant. Not in any settled abode did those twain dwell, nor had their realm boundaries well marked, and indeed no other messenger save Huon alone, to whom all ways were known, had ever found Beren and obtained his aid so soon. Note 13. A rejected passage in the manuscript here gives an earlier version of the events, according to which it was Gwendolen, not Huon, who brought the news to Beren, and her bitter weeping filled the forest. Now there did Gwendoling, sick, gather to her many of the scattered woodland elves, and of them did she hear how matters had fared even as she had guessed, how the hunting party had been surrounded and overwhelmed by the Naugloth, while the Indrafangs and orcs fell suddenly with death and fire upon all the realm of Tinwellant. And not the least host was that of Ufethan that slew the guardians of the bridge. And it was said that now Glaudur had slain Tinwellant when he was borne down by numbers, and folk thought Narthseg a wild elf had led the foemen hither, and he had been slain in the fighting. And seeing no hope, Gwendolen and her companions fared with the utmost speed out of that land of sorrow.